Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. The Kiev regime has a Nazi problem its Western backers don't want you to know about. Stepan Bandera, a Nazi collaborator, is celebrated in Ukraine as a national hero. However, the historical record is clear. Bandera and his associates are alleged to have committed genocide against Poles and Jews during the Second World War. The West is largely silent about this. Crosstalking Ukraine, I'm joined by my guest, Aaron Good, in Philadelphia. He's a political scientist, historian, and author of American Exception, Empire in the Deep State. And in London, we cross to Adriel Constante. He is the founder of AK Consulting and a foreign affairs analyst. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Let's go to London first. Ariel, on January 1st of this year, Bandera, his birthday was commemorated 114 years ago, officially commemorated in the national parliament and other official organs. And this is an atrocity. I mean, this is really what this regime is all about. But you never or hardly ever hear about it in Western media. I will point out that the Polish government strongly objected, as they usually do, but it doesn't seem to have any impact. So this is this the kind of regime that the West is protecting? Let's go to London first.
Yes. I mean, quite recently, the chief of the Ukrainian armed forces has been spotted on the social media by posting a picture or a selfie of himself next to the or under the portrait of the Stepan Bandera, as you rightly said, with a note saying that the Ukrainian, the final and ultimate victory of Ukrainian nationalism will be when the Russian Empire will cease to exist. So in my opinion, I think that the West is using the very strong and prevalent nationalist movements and sentiment within the whole Ukrainian society in order to fight Russia from the far. This is the same script we've seen in Afghanistan when during the Soviet era, Zbigniew Brzeziński was encouraging Mujahideens to fight in the name of God against the Soviets. And I think that the same template is being used here in Ukraine, where the Nazis the West is trying to somehow relabel as a far-right movement, which is not far-right, but is clearly supporting Nazi ideology, to fight Russia until the last Ukrainian will die. So I think that the answer to your question is yes.
Well, let me go to Aaron here, because this is very curious here, because the West, at least officially, its official narrative is that it's a vehemently against ethno-nationalism. But they're supporting a regime in Kyiv that is all about ethno-nationalism, okay? As Adriel has already pointed out, I mean, this is a tool in their Russophobic arsenal. It really has nothing to do about Ukraine, has nothing to do about the fate of the Ukrainian people, but it has everything to do about Russia. And they're willing to tolerate ultra-nationalist, ethnic nationalist, even fascistic rhetoric to achieve that end. Aaron.
Right. And I think that these hardcore Nazi elements represent a minority of that Western Ukrainian population. But it really only takes a minority to be a pretty dangerous element in this society. And from the point of view of not just the Russians, but the ethnic Russians who have been part of Ukraine, these are the worst elements in the country that they live in. And it's a version of Nazism that traces back to the Nazis, and except that it's even more kind of focused on Russians. I mean, it's which is a for the people that are in, if you look at that electoral map from 2010 and you see the places that that did not that, that went for the, you know, the neutral candidate, it was, you know, around Odessa and the Donbass, you see that this is a really divided country, and the more hardcore elements in the West are have become, you know, have an almost genocidal, well, I mean, they do have a genocidal ideology of sorts towards Russians. And so the idea of it's going to make it difficult to imagine how this can be, how you can reintegrate this country in any, in the way that it was before. So the Nazi element is real. They really do downplay it in the West, especially once the war started. And this just goes back to the U.S. tradition of backing really anybody on the ground, whether it's mafia groups or jihadi groups, Italian fascists, German Nazis we swept up after the war, Japanese ultra-nationalists, basically Japanese fascists, Korean fascists, ultra-rightists, Taiwanese, all these groups that we used.
Well, and Aaron, I would even throw in the 31 flavors of jihadism in Syria, for example, you know, supporting the worst elements here. Let me go back to Adriel. I mean, you've already used a word in the program. I think it's really appropriate. Rebranding as the Azov battalion, for example. You know, and it was very curious. Very few people in Western media commented on it. Zelensky was asked this a few months ago. What about these battalions and ultranationalists? He said, well, they are who they are. I mean, he didn't even try to apologize for them. He just, that's who they are. That's what they are. And everybody knows it. We know that a Congress during the Trump era, you know, when appropriations were being made, there were Congress members saying, no, we can't give money to these groups. That was law. And then under the Biden administration, it was changed, you know, where you can fund these people. No one can claim they don't know about this. And if you go prior to 2014, a lot of these figures that are in places of power, they were condemned by the European Union. But the European Union says nothing now. Let's go back to London.
Yes, that's very true. I mean, if we go back to, I don't know, 1 or 2 years ago, the Western mainstream media was quite, open about the Nazi problem in Ukraine. Even the Atlantic Council, which is uber hawkish about a Russian question. So there's no doubt about it. Also, we have to bear in mind that the very prominent journalist, Polish-Jewish journalist in Poland, Konstanty Gebert, who was writing for many years for Gazeta Wyborcza, which is a very famous and a very popular newspaper in Poland, resigned due to the fact that the very editorial board of the newspaper was forcing him to rebrand the neo-Nazis, and he was insisting to call a spade neo-Nazis, to rebrand them to far right. So I am myself of Jewish heritage, and I don't feel all right with what is happening, and there is a lot of talking among the Jewish population in Poland and in United Kingdom as well. And those who are trying to somehow go against the mainstream narrative are being labeled as, you know, disloyal to whom? I mean, I'm loyal to the history of my family. I'm loyal to the tragedy that happened in Poland or on the Polish soil when the German Nazi occupied Poland and put my ancestors in the ghetto in Łódź, or others and friends of mine put in gas chambers. So I'm loyal to the history of my family and the history of part of my family. So I don't quite get why, you know, Volodymyr Zelensky is being legalized and somehow. You know, he's a Holocaust denial. If we go back to the peer research articles from 2020 written by the Grzegorz Rosoliński Lieber, he published very, very important article in the journal called Eastern European Politics and Society, where he called the genocide in Volhynia and Galicia a Holocaust. So people like Andriy Melnik, who was a former ambassador of Ukraine to Germany, now has been, promoted to be he's been promoted, and he's apparently a VP foreign minister in Ukraine. So he's a Holocaust denier. If something like this would happen in, I don't know, in any European country, trust me, the media, the mainstream media, the politicians would destroy any politician or any person who would be denying the Holocaust.
There's a higher cause here, okay? And let me go back to Aaron here. They're perfectly willing to accept a Holocaust denier if it advances their agenda to have the collective West attack Russia. That's perfectly acceptable to them. They have no moral scruples whatsoever. Aaron.
Right. I mean, this just gets into the amorality or immorality of the pinnacle of the American elite. If you look at the fascists in the first place, with Mussolini got $100 million loan from J.P. Morgan, and Henry Luce of Time magazine sort of wrote glowingly about him at the time. John Foster Dulles, representing people connected to Sullivan and Cromwell's law firm, he brokered a large bond sale internationally for the German Nazi regime, under Adolf Hitler, which helped Germany to rearm. And the idea was that this was a bulwark against
Russian Soviet communism.
And the U.S., it was the U.S. that was, and Standard Oil that was selling all the oil to the Japanese when they were sweeping across, up to the point where they invaded French Indochina. So they were fueling these Japanese wars in China, especially. So we supported them then, and then we turned against them to basically take over the fascist parts of the global empire and really make Japan and Germany into satellites and so on. But we scoop up a lot of these Nazis and fascists
I thought it was about democracy. Sorry, I didn't know this here. Okay, it's all about democracy versus autocracy. That's what we're all told here. No, I mean, both of my guests here are giving the real, pulling away the layers and saying really what the truth is. And Western publics have to learn more about this. If they don't, they don't have a moral conscience. I'm going to jump in here, gentlemen. We're going to go to a short break. And after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on Ukraine. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter LaBelle. To remind you, we're discussing Ukraine. Okay, now we're joined by Garland Nixon in Washington. He's a political analyst. Welcome to the program. In the first part of the program, Garland, we talked about the intentional whitewashing of fascist and neo-fascist elements in Ukraine, focusing on the personality of Stepan Bandera, whose birthday, the 114th, was celebrated officially by the Ukrainians on the first of the year. But, one of the things that, one of the reasons why this whitewash can continue is because the West does not want to come to terms with the illegal takeover of power in February of 2014. That is the origins of this. Aaron was right in the beginning of the program saying, these are a minority of people. Yes, but they are in very powerful positions, and they have very, very powerful backers in the West, okay? So, I mean, without a honest discussion about what happened with the illegal takeover of power in February of 2014, a coup, we're never going to get anywhere, because they were the stormtroopers, quite literally, of bringing that illegal process to fruition. Garland.
Well, and it's far worse than that. The United States has a position, the U.S. empire, shall I say, has a position here that it must hide from its people. The information war of the United States is one that is used to hide from the actual American people the truth here. The reality is, you are correct. There is a minority of the far right fascists, though growing at the behest of the United States and by the support of the United States, but the actual numbers of people in Ukraine who are far-right fascists aren't as high as many would think. However, they derived their power from the U.S. empire. They were empowered after 2014. They were integrated into the military after 2014 when the U.S. took over. So the U.S. is fighting an information war mainly to ensure that the American people cannot look at this conflict through a historical context, because that would expose the extremely immoral and unethical position that the United States is in here.
You know, Aaron, if we go back, to our guest in Philadelphia, there's the narrative is that suddenly, unprovoked, on February of last year, Russia invaded Ukraine. That's the Western narrative. But the origins of this conflict go all the way back to 2014 with the illegal takeover of power against the Yanukovych government. And what was the first thing the coup government did? They passed very stringent anti-Russian language laws. No wonder the people of the Donbass said, we're out of here. And the people in Crimea said exactly the same thing. They were the ones that voted for Yanukovych in the first place. This narrative never makes it, it doesn't even make the 13th paragraph. And what is very rarely mentioned is the 8 years prior to February of last year, up to 15,000 people died in the Donbass, and they were killed by the Kiev government, backed by the West. Go ahead, Aaron.
Right. The coup is of 2014 is the key moment to understand what has happened here, and it invariably gets lied about in the U.S. media. If I don't know anyone who is a longtime observer of U.S. Foreign policy, and especially of the clandestine state, and who has looked extensively at the coups and overthrows over the years, who has not come to the conclusion that Maidan was a U.S. operation that had all the same basic elements that they used to overthrow the government of Iran in 1953, massive street protests, false flag violence, and then key officials who were bribed and on the side of the coup plotters. So this is very straightforward. I mean, it's even more obvious in this case because you had the secretary or a State Department official, Victoria Nuland, passing out cookies to anti-government protesters. It's very straightforward, and it's never discussed. And so the debate in the U.S. is kind of a make-believe debate to the extent that there is a debate, and which is normal in the U.S. It really is a top-down policymaking system especially as far as foreign policy goes. And academics who point this out is a guy, Ivan Kachanovsky at the University of Ottawa, and he had a paper that went through peer review and was set to be published. Yep. And an editor basically stepped in and said, no, we can't publish this for political reasons, basically. So this is it's a taboo thing in the West, and it just means that the debate in the West is a make-believe debate.
Yeah, it's all make-believe. Adriel, you know, when I mention to people about the Minsk Accords, I get a blank look. Well, what's that? Okay. It sounds like propaganda to them. It's because no one is ever educated about them whatsoever. That, like I said, this conflict has been going on for going into 9 years right now, and that is the context that it has to be put into. And we have to be very fair here. The Russians warned the West that this was going to happen. They repeatedly warned that they would take measures to counter the West's expansion of NATO up to its doorstep, and it was completely ignored. What I'm saying, Adriel, there's a hell of a lot of context here that never makes it into the public debate in the West.
Well, that's a really interesting, Peter, that you've mentioned Minsk Accords or agreements. But I'm sure that the other panelists and yourself are aware that recently Angela Merkel give an interview in the
François Hollande also.
François Hollande gave an interview to a Kiev Independent, just confirming what she said in her interview. And basically, she said that from the very beginning, it was a chutzpah. They knew that they need to give some time to the Ukrainian military and neo-Nazis in order to strengthen their position vis-a-vis Russia. So I think that Russian people and many people in the West are quite naive in thinking that certain agreements are worth, you know, being, you know, I mean, the politicians in the West are trustworthy in the way that if they make any agreement, this agreement will not be broken. But she confirmed in this interview that any agreement with the West is worthless. I mean, if in 2014 they already knew that this Minsk agreements don't mean anything to the Western side and to the Ukrainian side, they were just deceiving Russia. So how the Russian Federation can trust West in the future? In my opinion, there's no trust And these reckless interviews, because if you are a liar, at least try to just prolong and keep on lying, but don't say it out loud, because at the moment, France and Germany are discredited, in my humble opinion.
Well, I mean, gentlemen, to my three guests and to my audience here, that's why this conflict is going to end very differently than the West expects, because Russia does not have an interlocutor that it can trust, because we have repeated lies. That's what is going to make ending this conflict, which it will end, but it will be with almost no input from the West for the reasons that Edriel has just said. Garland, let me go to you. I mean, the West is supporting fascist and fascistic elements in Ukraine, okay? But I find it, my friend, very, very peculiar that in the context of, like, American politics, you know, it's so easy for people to say, he's a fascist, you know, he's a Trumpian, all of this stuff here. And I don't want to get into domestic American politics, not right now, but I find it really peculiar that how easy people will throw the term around as a slur, but they won't even open their eyes to see real fascists in Ukraine that the U.S. is supporting and funding. Garland.
I do think there's some level of willful ignorance. And of course, in America, in a court of law, willful ignorance is treated as knowledge. It's if a court finds that you were willfully ignorant, then you are treated the same as if you know. And so the responsibility is there in the United States as people struggle with these two realities, in that they, you know, Joe Biden comes out and says, I'm running because of Charlottesville and I'm fighting against the Nazis, and we've got to stop Nazis. And of course, we're sending unlimited money to Nazis. And then people have to say, well, there are no Nazis there. Of course, there's all this information and data all around. So again, the importance of the information war here against the American people is to ensure that the American people don't come to grips with the reality of what they're facing. However, I'm here in the United States. I'm telling you, I do radio on both coasts all over the place. I can tell you that is changing. I can tell you that the questions are starting to get louder, and particularly with the economic pain that Americans are up against. So while it may appear, based on the mainstream media and what our politicians are saying, that the American people have no clue and are going along willfully, there is a growing contingent of Americans who are highly suspicious of what's going on, and the pushback is started. I don't know how long the neocons can hold on to this disaster, to this tiger that they have by the tail that they can't let go and they can't hold on to.
You know, Aaron, we're rapidly running out of time, but when Russia started its special military operation in Ukraine, it said it had two objectives: the demilitarization of Ukraine and denazification of Ukraine. The denazification element was the West could not comprehend, but it's easy to comprehend. The regime in Kyiv is not an interlocutor that the Russians take seriously. They're completely dependent on the West, and the only they're not people that you can trust. Zelensky ran as president as a peacemaker, and he was cowed by these fascist battalions, and this is where we've ended up. Go ahead, Aaron.
Yeah, as I understand it, he was one of his big backers was an oligarch who is also a big Azov founder. So you have to wonder how much his backers.
Kolomoisky, yes. Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. You have to wonder how much they ever intended to let him achieve his, you know, promised mission of peace here. But I think that a bigger, maybe a more fundamental issue here is that a historical understanding of fascism wherein the U.S. absorbs not just the Japan and Germany as the ends of its sort of global empire, you know, axial ends on each side of Eurasia, but also it takes their fascist personnel and some of the worst butchers of that regime, and it repurposes them against communist China and Soviet Union. And this in a way, it takes up the fascist project of domination of the globe led by a, you know, imperialist hegemon. And
from where I am, the Russian people thought they had defeated fascism in Europe 70 years ago. They feel like they have to do it again. I'm kind of echoing your thoughts there. Gentlemen, that's all the time we have. I want to thank my guests in Washington, Philadelphia, and in London. And I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. Remember, crosstalk rules.